RunDNA has an incredible range of running and walking footwear, apparel and accessories, catering for anyone who is looking for the right shoe and fit. They're trusted by podiatrists and physiotherapists right across Adelaide. The RunDNA fitter's advice is second to none. So if it's time for new walkers or runners, you can find RunDNA, 20 Manton Street, Hindmarsh, or the other location, 391 Fullerton Road at Fullerton. Both stores open 7 days a week, plenty of off-street parking. You can find them online as well, rundna.com.au. If you run or walk, then you need to RunDNA.
Thursday the 15th of May and welcome to Hooked on Sport. Lots of sports news this week, including a review of the showdown, which was played in front of a massive crowd last Saturday night. And we catch up with Colin Ralston, umpiring manager at the Adelaide Footy League. G'day, Hookie.
Wallace, yes, a big crowd at Adelaide Oval. And I've got to say, well-behaved crowd. I said last week I was very, very concerned. Late start on Saturday night, I would have preferred to see this game sort of Saturday in that twilight spot, or maybe an afternoon Sunday, or even a standalone Thursday or Friday. But got away with it. Crowd was very well behaved. I think in part, Wallace, the fact that the teams were pretty benign in the lead up with their showmanship. We remember last year it was Josh Rochelli talking about Port fans without teeth and all of those sorts of smart remarks, Port players saying that they can't stand the Crows. I think the fact that they toned it down led to a bit of a tone down of the way the two supporter bases went as well.
Yeah, it was interesting. Obviously, being a Swan supporter, I was just there to watch the game with no allegiances either way. Up in the Riverside stand, and it was fascinating. I reckon half the crowd were Port and half were Adelaide Crows. And it was so funny at one point in time when a goal got kicked, all the Adelaide supporters got up and cheered. And then they reviewed it and went, was it behind? So all the Port supporters got up and cheered for the point.
Yeah,
it was in a good spirit. The crowd was in good form.
I'm glad. I was concerned and I'm really relieved that there was no obvious incidents, that we ended up having yet another round of mea culpas and concerns over crowd behaviour, because we've had a string of them in showdown, some racist issues. I remember, wasn't there a banana thrown at Eddie Betts? You know, some pretty vile stuff. So I'm always concerned with those Saturday night time slots, which gives the opportunity for people to fuel up over the course of the afternoon. But a good crowd, well-behaved, and a great game. A couple of mistakes in it. What did you make of the game?
What a great contest. They were unbelievable. Great skill. And I thought it was tough. As I said, not invested in either team. I thought it was a great spectacle to watch.
Two things stood out to me. Port Adelaide's kicking let them down enough times that was probably the difference between winning and losing. If they weren't so careless with the footy, they probably would have won that game. And then the other thing I think about Adelaide, gee, they defend deep. They concede a lot of inside 50s. I don't know if that's by design or not. They're obviously a turnover team. We understand that they like to, if the other team has the ball, defend in a manner they try and turn the ball over and create the slingshot down the other way when a team is out of position defensively. But, gee, they give up a lot of inside 50s. And I'm really fascinated to see how that sort of a game plan stands up this week against Collingwood, because Collingwood, I think, will really hurt them if they don't get that absolutely right and they continue to concede territory like they have done in certainly a lot this year. But, you know, what are they? 6-3. They've been very, they've answered a lot of questions, haven't they? They were very good against Gold Coast and lost. They were okay against the Cats. That was on a 5-day break. They were poor to Fremantle away. There's their three losses. But then you think about it, they've beat two 2024 top four teams. They've beat St Kilda, Essendon and Carlton, who were all above them last year. And they've had just one easy kill. That was North Melbourne. So 6-3, they've got some tough games coming up. But they've done pretty much everything you would hope that you would see from them at this point of the year.
What's your assessment of the Crows list at the moment?
It's a really good question. I'm so glad you brought it up, because can I just talk about Justin Reid very quickly, who is the head of list management and strategy? He has been the punching bag of the Adelaide Football Club for the last 4 or 5 years. He was facing the sack as the man responsible for last year's poor season. I can remember Stephen Rowe on 5AA saying he should 100% get in the Bunsen burner. I don't know quite know how you get in a Bunsen burner, but you understand Rowe's language was to say he should be sacked, he should be moved on. By the end of last year, he was being linked to Collingwood. There were surveys in the Advertiser saying that, you know, he should be given an F and be moved on. Anyway, he's still there, and he should be a pretty massive curtain call right now, if you ask me. I want to just go through some recruiting from this. This is just some of the showdown winning team, all right? So Ben Keys came from the 2019 rookie draft, cost him nothing. Nick Murray came from the preseason supplementary list, cost them nothing. Jordan Dawson was pick 18, I think, from memory. James Peatling, free agent, cost them nothing. Isaac Rankin was a first rounder. I think he was pick 5, and that was money very, very well spent. Mitch Hinge comes from the rookie draft in 2017, cost them nothing. Nane Curvis from the preseason draft, cost them nothing. Alex Neil Bullen, cost them pick 30. I mean, that's money well spent. Mark Keane from the supplementary preseason list situation, cost them nothing. Isaac Cumming, free agent, cost them nothing. Rory Laird, a rookie elevation in 2013, cost them nothing. It is just amazing when you think about it. So all of those guys combined, essentially are two first rounders and one second rounder for all of those players. And to those who were potting him, I would say Justin Reid is a bit of a genius. In fact, if the Adelaide Football Club wins the flag in the next 2 years, the statue that's going to be built shouldn't be of Taylor Walker or Matthew Nix. It should be Justin Reid. His list management has been off the charts. He has quite frankly gone from punching bag to the best pugilist off the field that the Adelaide Footy Club has. So I am saying it right now. The Justin Reid haters need to take a good hard look at themselves. He has done an incredible job running that list.
So, Hooky, Damien Hardwick has got some ideas about doubling up AFL games and reducing them to only 2 points each. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. Wallace, yes. Fascinating, isn't it? And I love a radical solution to maybe a problem that isn't really there. So his request of the AFL on Monday night on AFL 360, whenever in a season you play a team twice, so, for example, the showdowns, always two games in 1 year, that those games are only worth 2 points. So wouldn't that be amazing if we said that the win that Adelaide had over Port Adelaide was only worth half a win against the teams that you only play once over the course of the year? It's an interesting theory, isn't it? I mean, regardless of ladder position, traditionally it's always been 6-6-6. So if you finish in the top six, you were roughly supposed to play the other five teams a second time. This is before Gather Round came in. If you're in the middle six, you'd play the middle six a second time. And if you're at the bottom six, you'd play the bottom six a second time. But it's never quite that simple, because all of the interstate derby matches, if you like, so the showdown, the Western Derby, the Q Clash, and the Battle of the Bridge, they always play each other twice, regardless of ladder position. I was having a look through. Collingwood has played Essendon twice, except for 2 years, the COVID year and one other, going back to 1992. So they play each other twice really every year. And Collingwood and Carlton are the same thing. They've only missed two going back to 1992. Three. One of them was the COVID year. So I actually do think it is reasonable to reduce their influence in the season. Carlton will play North Melbourne and West Coast, both of them twice this year. So where they're flailing a bit outside the top eight, they're every chance of making it back in simply on the fact of who they're going to play in their double up games. So I think it's a bit much to suggest that of the 23 matches, 12 of them are only worth 2 points. So your six double ups, each time you play them, that game's only worth 2 points. I feel like that's probably too many. But I do feel like the second meeting between the two teams, maybe that one should be worth 2 points. So, yes, the Adelaide-Port Adelaide result stands. But when those two teams meet with the Adelaide home game in about round 21, I think it is, then I'm very comfortable for that one to be worth 2 points, just to reduce by a bit the influence that it can have by the lopsided draw and the fact that you can end up with a very, very soft run with your double-up matches. So, yeah, one that I imagine the AFL will hate to admit that they've probably got to think about.
Be very interesting to see where that gets to. Now, draws in AFL footy or play extra time?
Well, yeah, good question. So this really comes out of the fact that Brisbane and North Melbourne played a draw in the final game of the round Sunday evening in Hobart on the weekend. Good game of footy. Wasn't it great to see essentially the top team or the reigning premier and the bottom team play out such a close match? I think that's fascinating for a start. You know what? I'd leave draws alone. I mean, they've finally standardised finals, and I think that's reasonable to have an arrangement that you've got to get through a final on the day. I think that makes sense. But the draw in home and away footy has become a real curiosity, and I just think we should retain it. it affects the season in a quaint manner right throughout the year where percentage becomes moot, but you've got these extra 2 points that you manage to collect over the course of a draw. And the post-siren shared anguish, I think, is an appreciable moment. So, yes, keep the extra time, but only for the super rarity, and that's a drawn final. Everything else, I think the result of a drawn match is perfectly acceptable.
Turning to cricket, should the Australian cricketers be returning to the IPL?
Yeah, I think they should. I mean, I find it difficult to feel sorry for the players being called back as we speak. I kind of feel like you know what you've signed up for. I mean, the IPL is an extraordinarily wealthy competition. It's paying untold riches, but it's not compulsory to play. You're playing in a relatively unpredictable, quite volatile part of the world. The tensions aren't new, and the build-up of the concern between India and Pakistan over the Kashmir region has been bubbling away, certainly at a heightened level, for quite some time. We know that India refused to play the Champions Trophy in Pakistan due to security measures, so you can't be completely surprised that there was inevitably going to, something was going to go wrong. I mean, the one thing that I find fascinating in all of this is the IPL's bravado in management in the face of war to schedule that game in Dharamshala, only what, 60, 70 miles from the Kashmir border. It's just craziness. But that is India, and that is the IPL, which really is an extension of the Indian government. You know, there's two relatives who are, you know, one's it's father and son running the Indian government, essentially, and the IPL hand in hand with the BCCI. So, look, I just find that if you are going to be prepared to put yourself in these sorts of situations for the enormous check that is on the end of it, you need to accept that there's going to be some chaos that comes with it. Yes, the money is life-changing, but I don't think you can grizzle when that chaos eventually seeps in. The test is next year for the IPL and the Australian players in particular. I mean, this India-Pakistan war isn't vanishing. The tensions aren't vanishing. If the players refuse to return now, are they going to be chasing a large check in 2026? I suspect they might. It lacks a little bit of authenticity, I think, in the character of these people if they're saying, no, it's all too dangerous now, but gee, you better make sure you put me on an absolutely enormous check when I turn around and want to put my hand up to play next year. So, yeah, I just think it's incumbent upon these players to return, play out the competition, and then head on to the World Test Championship, which is, what, June 11?
Now, Virat Kohli has retired. What's his legacy, Hooky?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he's receiving unbridled affection right around the world right now, and I'm not convinced that he deserves it all. He's a wonderful player, a fantastic captain, a great leader of men, but he was as impetuous as he was imperious. He was cantankerous as he was glorious. He was sort of equal parts glossy and gruff. And it's been said he was the developer of the great uprising, the persona of cricket in India. I kind of disagree. I think Indian cricket has become so totalitarian in its nationalist attitude. Behaviours like Kohli's have been a rage unchecked. He's sort of exploited it. He's exploited a capacity to sort of run roughshod over his own nation to his own detriment and to the game's detriment. And I think that's been really unfortunate. He'll be remembered as a true great, and he should. He deserves that. But I also think the ungraciousness accompanying the way he's gone about a lot of his cricket shouldn't be forgotten either. So, yeah, big fan of Virat Kohli. Love the way he's played the game. But I think a lot of what has gone on in and around the way he's played the game has been unfortunate and will always leave a little bit of an asterisk alongside his career.
Now, Hooky, it appears that Victoria have caught a big fish in Rory McIlroy being announced as the lead golfer for the next two Australian Opens, which will be at Royal Melbourne and then at Kingston Heath, both in Victoria. I'm really interested in your thoughts about what the impact will be for the LIV event in Adelaide.
Wallace, I think a rising tide lifts all boats. I think it will be actually great for golf as a spectator sport here in Australia to have both of those events, one in December, one in February. I think they can actually work pretty well hand in hand with each other. I don't know that they'll be necessarily doing each other great favours. Certainly Rory Rory McIlroy isn't going to be promoting LIV anytime soon. But I do think big-time golf with big-time players, in particular playing at such an amazing course like Royal Melbourne, will be great for professional men's golf and the crowds that it will attract overall. It's a huge check they've signed. The Victorian government, I think, is paying $3 million for Rory McIlroy. But as the Masters champion, he'll come here with the green jacket. That is going to be something really special for golf. And for it to be played at Royal Melbourne, I think it's around about 30 years since an Australian Open has been played at Royal Melbourne. It is the composite course there is one of the world's great golf courses, Wallace. So to see Rory, who I imagine will bring a bit of a field in his own right, because all eyes are going to be on it. I suspect that they'll be able to pump up the prize money a little bit with Rory coming and the ticket sales and the sponsorship that he will drive. So yeah, I think it's going to be an amazing event for Victoria and for Royal Melbourne. And I think it will actually do some good, because there are a lot of Australian male players who play that Australian Open and still going to front up for LIV. Cameron Smith, the obvious one. So imagine if Cam Smith and Rory McIlroy are dueling it out on the last day. I think that would be amazing for LIV. And who knows, you know, because there'll be some ranking points on it now. Guys like Patrick Reed and Brooks Koepka and Bryson DeChambeau, who are crying out for rankings points, they may turn up as well. And wouldn't that be something really special?
Hooky, let's get into your quick bites.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk up the South Australian Netball Premier League. They're playing tonight, I reckon, so it's Wednesday afternoon. We've got four teams on the ladder at the moment with four wins from five matches. South Adelaide, who were last year's minor premier, they've had a tough draw early and they lost their first four. So they're one from five, but they can still win it. Tango are sniffing around, but then you've got the top four at the moment, which is Garville making an amazing resurgence. They were the club of the 1980s and 1990s, and here they are back again after I guess being a bit of a mediocre club in the last 10 to 15 years. Matrix are there. Oakdale are making a bit of a return as well, which is great to see in context, who are the reigning champions. So they've brought in these rules where you get points for the recruits that you bring in. And there's only a certain amount of points that each team gets allocated. So you can't just recruit heaps and heaps and heaps of players, which Matrix and Contax were very, very good at in the year. If you were a reasonable young player at another club, you were recruited by the two big clubs and it was difficult to say no. So the fact that Garville's making a bit of a resurgence, that Tango are sniffing around, South Adelaide we've already seen working their way up to the top, it shows these rules are working. It's slowly working, but it is surely working, Wallace. So I just wanted to mention South Australian netball going very nicely.
What else you got in your quick bites, Hooky?
Port Adelaide Cricket Club, the team heading into women's second grade for the summer. I'm a big admirer of the Port Adelaide Cricket Club these days. They had some real challenges around 20, 25 years ago, but they are standing up for themselves. They're taking their future in their own hands. It's a gritty club doing a lot right. Now, they had a very, very successful program for reasons beyond my comprehension. It all sort of fell apart around about 15 to 20 years ago. But the fact that they're making steps in the right direction to get back into women's cricket, amazing. So I just wanted to give a big shout out to the Port Adelaide Cricket Club for what they're doing down there at Port Reserve. I just want to quickly mention the Marjorie Jackson Nelson Centre for Women's Sport. It's run by Sport SA. It's had great support from the South Australian government and the Helix Group. It is a program that's supporting and empowering female athletes, coaches, officials, administrators, volunteers, board members, you name it, to, I guess, take steps in advancing their own career in sport. Women have been terribly underrepresented in sport and in key sporting roles for many, many years now. So this program is designed to try and address that imbalance. It's available for anyone. It doesn't matter whether you are working at the elite levels from the Adelaide Crows or elite cricket, right down to a voluntary grassroots role. There is something in this program for you. And I would encourage you, if you're listening to this, get onto the site, the Marjorie Jackson Nelson Centre for Women's Sport. Put in an application and just see if there's something that might be in it for you. There is incredible core modules. There's elective modules. And if you get involved in the program, it's going to be something that you can really take right throughout your sporting career that could see you advanced into all sorts of incredible roles that traditionally women have been, I guess, shunned from. So I really want to see people get involved in the Marjorie Jackson Nelson Centre for Women's Sport. And if I can just wrap up, I do want to make mention as well of the Festival of Sport that's run by Sport SA. As you know, I've got a link with Sport SA, involved with the Sport SA Hall of Fame Selection Committee. The Festival of Sport is on the 22nd and the 23rd of May. Cathy Freeman is the guest speaker. I mean, my goodness, has there been a bigger moment in Australian sport than Cathy Freeman winning the 400 at the Sydney Olympics in 2000? I think not. It would be just incredible to listen to her speak for a while. There is another incredible list of experts and guests that are going to be there. So if you're anyone who loves your sport and you've got some ambition or desire to be involved in the administration of sport, then get along and apply, or don't even have to apply, just buy a ticket to go along to the Festival of Sport. It will be something really special and something that I know, sometimes it's tough to get motivated to get people along to these things, but every time these things are run, people walk out going, oh my goodness, I'm so glad I came. And so I just would hate for people not to get the opportunity to go and see what's going on at the Festival of Sport that's on in a couple of weeks' time. So again, just Google Sport SA Festival of Sport, and you'll be able to get access to what is a really incredible couple of days of learning and opportunities and networking.
And Hooker, are you going to be there?
I'll definitely be there. Yes, yes. I'm going to be there on the Thursday. I'll be hearing from Cathy Freeman. I'll be in and out a little bit on the Friday. I've also got the City of Charles Sturt Sport Awards on the Thursday night. So busy couple of days for me, mate. But yes, 100%, I'm going to be at the Festival of Sport. I cannot wait.
After the break, we catch up with Colin Ralston, umpiring manager from the Adelaide Footy League.
If you're enjoying this podcast, I'd encourage you to take a listen to Beyond the Club. It's a project I've been working on with Flinders University. Now, I co-host it with Professor Sam Elliott, and we break down all the latest research on how to maximise the experience of junior and club athletes. There's a range of resources, special guests, and cutting-edge info on how you can make your club a safer, happier place for your kids and their club mates. Beyond the Club, wherever you get your podcasts. Umpiring in Australian rules football is in the news. We thought we'd take a bit of a different tack on it and chat to the man who was responsible for around about 70 games of football in South Australia every week. He's the boss of the Adelaide Footy League umpires, former umpire himself, 310 games of SNFL football, 3 grand finals, and 33 AFL games now for 10 years, has been steering the ship for the umpires at the Adelaide Footy League. His name is Colin Ralston. He's been good enough to join us. Colin, welcome to Hooked on Sport.
Hooky, thanks for having me.
I'm doing my maths here. You must have a staff of in excess of 400 who you send out each week to oversee, 70-odd games of footy?
Got some very committed people with our umpiring group, but it's not quite that. Yeah, we've got a list of over 450 registered umpires, and we've got about 30 coaches that are supporting them. I'm the only one that's employed by the Adelaide Footy League to manage it all. I've got the likes of Peter Angel, who is an absolute legend of Adelaide Footy League umpiring, who assists me, and a fella called Ray Roberts, who is super committed to boundary umpiring, and his son Andrew. So I'm surrounded by fantastic people that make this work.
10 years, Colin, and I can recall back, you know, a long time ago, it was probably very, very difficult to find umpires. I don't know if that's still the case for you. I rang you last week about having a chat, and the first thing you asked me is if I wanted to umpire a game. So I guess recruiting is ongoing. But are you proud of what you've been able to create over that decade?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I wanted you back, mate, because you're a good umpire. That was why I asked you that night. Always looking to recruit. And, you know, people ask me, are you short of umpires? And I guess if you look at the appointments we have each week, we've always got gaps that we're trying to fill. But it's because there's so much footy. I think you mentioned 70 games per week. You may have forgotten the women's footy as well. So it's more like 120 games of footy each week.
Wow.
And we've, for the first time this year, we've managed to cover all of those games with field umpires. Obviously, there's a lot of boundary and goal umpires that we can't cover, and the clubs have to. But yeah, when I came along, I couldn't give you the exact numbers, but I would have tripled the numbers in a fairly short space of time, and we've gradually built that up over the years. And where the growth has been in the last 3 or 4 years has been the boundary umpiring ranks. It's been absolutely remarkable. We've got a lot of young kids that have come on board, that have enjoyed the experience, and they tell their friends, and we've just built that number, which has been amazing. Just for boundary umpires, we've probably doubled or tripled their numbers in the last 4 or 5 years, which has been huge. So, yeah, it's been a team effort. Obviously, I'm passionate about what I do. I love recruiting umpires because I know how good it can be. But, you know, there's a lot of people to take credit for it. And the Adelaide Footy League, with its dance on on-field violence and umpire abuse, has created a much better culture for umpires to come in and want to stay umpiring. So, yeah, it's been challenging but so rewarding.
As an extension of that, and your point's well made about the Adelaide Footy League and how strong they've been on-field violence and in particular umpire abuse, has that, I guess, built the morale of the group that you work with?
Oh, absolutely. They feel very supported, and they know that if they take action on the field, that they'll be backed up. You know, and so there's a process in place when someone does report an incident which, you know, needs a suspension. And if we go through the process and realise that the umpire may be overreacted, we can find a way to deal with that without giving a suspension, withdraw it or downgrade it to yellow cards or whatever. But on the whole, if something serious happens and the umpires take action, they know the league want to deal with that.
Cole, how does the relationship between, I guess, when umpiring is in the spotlight at AFL level, does that affect your group? Are you completely immunised from that, or is there a trickle-down effect?
Well, there comes a time every year. I've been involved in umpiring for 35, maybe close to 40 years, and there hasn't been a year where we don't get to about this time of year where there is a criticism of umpires and media speculation about, you know, is the worst it's ever been. And it sells newspapers. It gets people listening to radio or watching TV or these days clicking on a story. So it's journalists' job to make controversy. So it's just part of umpiring. But we have a Zoom meeting these days on a weekly basis on a Monday night for our field umpires. And so we talk about the issues at AFL level and our level. And often the, you know, story of the moment, you know, in AFL, we'll get some traction and we'll discuss it. And there are things that obviously impact locally that happen at AFL. So, you know, we can talk about some of the stuff that's going on and learn from it. But, yeah, we're also very aware that umpiring is a challenging business at any level. So I'm really strong on our umpires and not to get involved in criticism of AFL umpires on social media or any other media. I tell them, if you're going to be critical of an AFL umpire for anything they've done, karma will come and bite you because you go out and umpire this week and something will happen where you'll cop criticism. So it's part of the nature of umpiring that things come up and you have to deal with it. And yes, umpires don't always get it right. But yeah, I've been around long enough to kind of see what happens in the media and take some of it with a pinch of salt.
Yeah, and things move along pretty quickly, don't they? One thing I'm interested in, and I remember it was quite confronting for me when I came back and umpired a couple of games with you a few years ago, that there are quite distinct differences in some of the rules between AFL, which we're all exposed to when we all watch, and the structure of the game at local level. So, you know, last touch out of bounds, how holding the ball is adjudicated, 25 and 50 metre penalties, 6-6-6, and there's a range of rules. How difficult is that to manage, and in particular expectations of clubs who maybe aren't aware that the rules are different and players that you have to manage, whereas your umpires have got to be across some quite significant differences between the way it's adjudicated at AFL and community level?
So for the first time ever, I've gone out to some clubs at the start of this year in the pre-season period. I started with the Div 1 men's clubs, and it was a bit of an educational session, and I did focus on the differences between AFL and Adelaide Footy League umpiring. And yes, of course, you've got the rules that are different. You've highlighted a few of them there and the list keeps growing. You know, AFL do introduce rules that aren't always relevant to local footy. So, you know, we pick and choose what we will adopt. And to highlight those differences, for the last few years, done a video at the start of the year, an interpretations video, which is available for all the umpires and all the coaches and all the players and spectators, anyone that wants to watch it, and says, you know, at AFL level, you know, you've got 666, you've got stand, you've got, you know, ruck nominations, you've got all these other things that we don't have at local level. So it's important to educate everyone about those rule differences. But something that's really been of interest to me in the last year or two is not just the rule differences, but how is my coaching of local umpires different to the coaching that the AFL umpires get? And I've realised that there's quite significant differences because at AFL level, they've obviously got the four umpire system, which they need for the pace of the game at that level. They've got the match comms. They've got, you know, the video that looks through every single incident. We don't have all that stuff at local level. So what AFL coaches of umpires tell their umpires with a four umpire system is quite often very different to what I'm telling our umpires. And it's quite interesting. We've got our own objectives to get through a game, keeping it under control, and we don't have the things that AFL matches have. So, yeah, as well as the rule differences, there's actual differences in the way our umpires are coached.
Obviously, AFL four umpire system. Are you two or three umpire system, Cole?
Pretty much for nearly all our games, a two umpire system.
Wow.
We have introduced a three umpire system into one or two Division One men's games per week. The reason we did that is because at men's Division One level, it is a really good standard, and a two umpire system is very physically challenging. And I think we're probably one of the only umpiring lists in the country these days that still have a time trial that impacts on performance on appointments. And so we have a 3K time trial that really measures the fitness and the readiness for umpires to be able to run at Div 1. But we have some good umpires that aren't able to get that fitness requirement, and we want them having the opportunity to still umpire at Div 1. So we do have, you know, out of 120 games, we have one or two each week, which is a three umpire system. But yeah, when we get the finals, everything's back to two. And yeah, that's all we need.
Mm-hmm. You talked about vision and how the AFL, they've got all of this vision, SNFL as well, but that's increasingly becoming a part of the Adelaide Footy League. Do you use the vision that you can get access to? Because I think every Div 1 game at least is videoed. And I reckon, you know, down through the grades, that's pretty common these days.
Yeah, so all A-grade men's games are videotaped and the Div 1 women's games are taped. So, yes, I think a lot of the umpires who umpire those games love to go home and analyse themselves. I've got four sons, two of them are field umpires, and I know they always go back and watch themselves. And I know many of the other umpires on our list do the same. But because I'm so busy in my job, I don't get much of a chance to analyse it all. I do review one game for half a game each week and do an analysis of each free kick, whether it's correct, warranted or missed. And we put that on Dartfish. Anyone can look at those reviews each week.
Wow.
So I do manage to look at half a game each week. We do use the footage for our coaching videos that I'll put together for our Zoom meeting each week. So, yes, we definitely make the use of the videos for coaching purposes. But it's when we're talking about AFL and reportable instances, we don't have umpires going and looking to report off video. I don't go looking for it either. It's a different process in place.
On that basis, I mean, you're reviewing half a game out of, what did we say, 120 each week. How do you assess the relative strengths and weaknesses of umpires and therefore, I guess, select on merit up and down the grades?
Out of the 30 coaches that we've got working with us, probably half of those are field umpire coaches looking at the games each week, and they feedback reports to me and to the umpires themselves. I get alerted to umpires that are either too high or too low in their appointments and take that feedback into consideration. And we've got a scoring system for our Div 1 umpires that helps us separate at the end of the year. It's pretty hard to separate. We've actually got a pretty strong Div 1 panel. And so separating those umpires that put their heart and soul into it, and all umpire pretty well during the year, trying to work out who does the Div 1 grand final as opposed to Div 7 grand final. We don't always get it right, but we've got a system in place that helps.
If there was one thing that you would like to see at AFL level from an umpiring perspective that would be easily transferable to your league, is there anything that you would say, I wish AFL would do more of this because that would be better for the community game?
Oh, it's a good question. It's a good question. Because it's such a different game and different environments, I did like that crackdown on umpire descent a couple of years ago. I know it was really unpopular, but I guess when players and umpires see stuff happen at AFL level, it tends to transfer into our game. So I did like that transition. I've got an answer for you. One area that I think AFL umpires aren't strong enough on and we're having our own crackdown this year because we think it's an issue, is what we call false bravado. So when a player has been run down in a tackle, holding the ball, and they get the free kick against them, I think it's just, not just me, John Kerr and others in the league, hate it when that tackler comes in and rubs the player who's been tackled out of free kick against them, their head in the ground, they push him. So we've instructed our umpires this year, if it's a really obvious push into head in the ground, just reverse it.
Yep.
And if it's not quite at the point where it needs to be reversed, we hold the player up. We tell the player, don't do that again. Right now, I'm going to hold the player up until all your teammates have been manned up on, and that's a penalty. So just don't do it. And I see it too often at AFL level where that happens, that the player who's run down a tackle and holding the ball, they get some other free kick and they want to get in the face of the player who's had the free kick against them. And it's just crap. You know, it's just false bravado that we're taking action on, and I don't think the AFL umpires are doing that just yet.
False bravado. I love it. How's that been received?
They're getting the message. It was actually interesting that Eddie Maguire came out a couple of weeks ago on whatever show he's on these days, and he talked about a rule to deal with exactly that, and he used examples of AFL games where it wasn't being dealt with, and used examples of other sports, rugby, and I think it might have been gridiron or somewhere from overseas. He saw it as a problem, and I totally agree with what he had to say.
Mm. Colin, just maybe to round things out, as you said, you're always on the lookout, always recruiting, and you don't have to be a 20-something sprinter around a boundary line or someone who's an absolute expert on football to get into umpiring. And, you know, you can be a bit older and maybe take up goal umpiring, and everyone knows that 6 points for a goal, 1 point for a behind. What would you, the obvious answer is get in contact with Colin Rouston at the Adelaide Footy League, but what would you encourage someone to do as the start point, the first step, if they thought, yeah, actually, I wouldn't mind giving umpiring a bit of a go? Where do they head?
Well, obviously get in touch, because there's a spot for anyone and everyone. Mm. And so if you don't want to take on the challenges of field umpiring straight up or even not at all, you know, boundary and goal give you a chance to get involved without having too much responsibility, but they have an important role, but there's not a lot to learn initially to be able to do the job. So if you like running, obviously boundaries to go, you don't like running, goal umpiring to go. And then the field umpiring, obviously some people really like to be involved in the thick of the action. So we do have plenty that start as boundary or goal and transfer to field, but our list, as I said, there's over 450 on there. We have them as young as 11, so when they're really that young, they're boundary or goal umpires. They normally start as umpiring senior footy as field umpires when they're about 16. But as young as 11, and our oldest umpire is 81. That's Rob Keneally, who's a goal umpire. We've got a couple of field umpires that aren't far off that. The legendary Barry Lewis is in his late 70s. David Bales and a few other names that you may be aware of that have been around forever. And it's just a great involvement. And we do get ex-players that come along and want to get involved. And often you get the comment, "Oh, I wish I'd started this earlier."
Mm.
Hey, Colin, is that the Ron Keneally, the same Ron Keneally who's the baseball umpire?
He is indeed.
Mate, he is an absolute man. He is a legend of a guy. He is very well revered and loved in the baseball community, and I think he's probably umpired more baseball games than anyone.
The only thing that frustrates me with Ron is we have a system where you get your appointment either on your phone or your computer, and you have to accept it. We ask them to accept it on Tuesdays, and anyone that hasn't accepted by Wednesday morning, I send out a reminder text message, and Ron is often on my list because he's a bit IT illiterate.
I tell you what, my father, he's pushing 81. He has a little bit of trouble with something as simple as a text message too. So I'm forgiving Ron Keneally. Yeah. Just on that, Cole, and there's a couple that have just sprung to mind here. Do you liaise with other umpire directors or umpire managers of other sports? Is there any correlation between, for example, baseball or cricket? Do you liaise with those guys?
Not really. Bump into occasional, basketball referee or cricket umpire and have a bit of a chat, but we don't really go out of our way to compare notes. Perhaps we should. We share an office, Adelaide Footy League, with the Turf Cricket Association. So, yeah, maybe that's something I need to do.
Women recruiting going well, I believe?
Yeah, so it's something that I think we should have seen a long time ago, especially with the growth in women's footy. I've been waiting for more women to come on board. We are really keen. We've brought on female umpire mentors to help them feel supported. We've gone out and sought new female umpires from schools, in particular St. Aloysius College, who have been fantastic. So while our numbers are still relatively small, I think we've gone from last year a total of 29 female umpires to currently 46. So we're heading in the right direction for sure.
For everyone who turns up and umpires a game officially for the Adelaide Footy League, there's a couple of bucks on the end of it, isn't there? I mean, no one's going to become a billionaire umpiring Adelaide Footy League, but everyone gets a check.
Absolutely, and it's tax-free money too at this level, so it is 100% worth doing for that. You won't get a better hourly rate anywhere. As I said before, I've got four sons. They all umpire, and I can't offer pocket money anywhere near what they get through umpiring, and it's their favourite part of the week when the money comes into their account.
Just to wrap us up, mate, last one. What do you think your group of umpires under your stewardship does really well? And what's the one area where you think I would love this to be our next big step forward?
Well, I think the love of the game is always something umpires have had. And I just know our umpires love footy. They love being involved. They love providing a service. They're passionate. And I think that's always been the case and always will be the case. You don't go out there and umpire and put up with some of the stuff I have to put up with without having that passion. So I just love my job because I'm involved with such good people that love footy just like I do. So really proud of, you know, how committed they are and how they want to do a good job. What can we do better? I think the really challenging part for field umpires in recent years has been dealing with the issue of dangerous tackles.
Mm-hmm.
We took a stance a few years ago of trying to crack down on it, and the footy community wasn't ready for it. We copped a lot of criticism. We sort of had to back off a little bit. But these days, it's actually the reverse. If we don't take action, we get criticism. And so I would love our group as a whole to be a little bit stricter in dealing with dangerous tackles. And even if we pay a few soft free kicks or whatever, I think the issue of concussion and player safety is so big. I think we need to be a little bit better at times in dealing with some of those tackles that shouldn't be a part of the game.
Colin, you're a wonderful chat, mate. Fantastic conversation. Your passion really stands out, and what you've done with the organisation, I think, is something you can be really proud of. Hey, thanks so much for your time.
Anytime, Hooky. Loved it.
That's a wrap on another episode of Hooked on Sport. Special thanks to our guest, Colin Ralston. And a quick reminder to follow us and leave a review if you enjoy what you hear. Your support helps Hooked on Sport reach even more sports-minded people just like you. I'm Wallace Long, and Ben and I look forward to your company next week on Hooked on Sport.